As September winds down, we discuss the stories that made headlines in Maine. Senator Susan Collins made national headlines this week when she announced her opposition to the latest Republican health care proposal. Here at home, political watchers are waiting for signs as to whether Collins will run for governor. She says she'll make the announcement by the end of this month. That's soon. Governor LePage this week threatened to fire any county sheriff who does not comply with immigration and customs requests to house detainees without a warrant. And earlier this month, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke made his recommendations to the president about the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. But we've heard nothing from the president about this since then. I'm Jennifer Rooks, today on Maine Calling, the month in Maine news. But first, this update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. On Monday, Maine's senior senator, Susan Collins, once again said that she would vote no on the latest plan to replace Obamacare, and in doing so, effectively ended the latest Republican attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. In other news this month, the Interior Secretary recommended some changes to the management of the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument, and Governor LePage suggested that he would remove sheriffs who do not cooperate with federal ICE agents' requests. These are just a few of the stories we'll talk about today with three editorial page editors, Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram and host of the Press Herald podcast, and Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. As always, we want to hear from you. Which stories in September mattered most to you? What perspective on that story do you think is being under-discussed? We'd love you to join us. 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome back to all of you. Greg, Senator Collins continues, even though her announcement was Monday, she continues to receive national attention for her consistent opposition to the different iterations of Republican health care bills. How has all of this changed her standing in the nation, in the Senate, in the state?
Well, I think consistent is the right word. She had issues with every version of the bill that she was very clear about that were involved both the substance of the bill, the fact that it would result in fewer people having health insurance, and also in the process by which the bill was created. And every step along the way, other Republicans have hammered together bills on the fly, taking a very complicated piece of legislation with no committee process, no input from experts, and every step of the way, she said, "I can't support a bill that's going to take health care away from millions of people, and I can't support a bill that's written in this form." So, in terms of her status in the nation, I think she's really risen to a level of prominence that she's never had before. She's seen as this very solid, moderate, principled voice. She's not, she's not surprising people every step of the way that like some of her colleagues are. She's not bending over backwards to find a way to support something that she used to be against in the past. And that, in today's political world, that's very unusual. In the state, I think she has always had critics on the right who feel that she's not really a conservative or not really a Republican. They call her a rhino, a Republican in name only. And she's done nothing to disarm them. However, she has, I think, quieted a lot of skepticism people on the left have had of her, saying, giving kind of vocal support to issues, but then in the end voting with her party. So I think, she's probably the most popular member of Congress in their home state in the country. Mm. And I think that gives her also gives her some credibility down in Washington.
You know, it's interesting. I stayed up on Monday night after she made her announcement reading through the comments on the New York Times article about this, which I don't usually do. But they were so interesting because they were so personal and so passionate towards her. It was not, oh, thank goodness this is, you know, dead. It was not. The comments were personal. Thank you, Susan Collins. You are my hero. I am a liberal who lives in New Mexico, and you just saved my health care. Susan, do you think that she has expressed publicly her frustration with her position and how she feels like she's on the firing line every single day? Do you think, has anyone talked to her that the response since Monday has affected her in any way? And
I think it's been positive, as you say, people thanking her, and she's heard that from a lot of her constituents as well. I mean, we had the spectacle of Mike Pence and Governor LePage trying to sway her vote, and her comment that she would listen to all of her constituents, I thought, was pretty pointed towards the governor. And I don't think it's going to change how she governs, especially on this issue. Those personal stories were very important to her because, as Greg said, it was about ensuring that more people don't end up without health coverage, making sure that rural hospitals are stable. They get, you know, so much of their money from Medicaid, and ensuring that those hospitals can stay in business so they employ local people. It was about health care, but also about jobs and the economy.
All right. Ben, I'm going to pivot but still talk about Susan Collins. She has said publicly that she will announce whether she's running for governor by the end of the month. It is almost the end of the month. Do we know?
We don't know anything for sure yet. I think a month ago, it was 2-1 against her running for governor, and I think I was the one who said she was going to run. I think Greg and Susan made a really good argument there, though, and it hasn't changed. If anything, the things that would persuade her to keep her in Washington are probably stronger than they were when we were here a month ago. She is, besides being an incredibly popular senator, she's maybe the most important senator in Washington right now. And to give that up to come home and face what could be a really tough primary here in Maine doesn't seem like a calculation she'd make.
Well, let's talk about the primary. Another announcement today, Garrett Mason. Am I counting right? Do we have 16 people already announced to run for governor?
Sure, that sounds good. Yeah, you want to name them off?
No, I did that earlier today and didn't write them down, just made little hash marks. But and we're talking about November 2018. Mm-hmm. Some have speculated the pool of possibilities is more like 36.
Mm. Yeah, there's still names out there who people expect to run. It's going to be a crowded field. It's a crowded group of Republicans, a crowded group of Democrats, and a bunch of independents. And we know it's going to at least be a three-way race. They'll probably all be three-way races from now on. And it's remarkable that no one really stands out in the field. There isn't maybe that's why there's so many. It's because there isn't someone like a Susan Collins that might come in and clear the field. If I'm remembering right, this is going to be the first real Democratic governor's primary in a long time. You know, they kind of appointed Mike Michoud 4 years ago. They did the same thing 4 years before that. And then it was the Baldacci administration. And the last two times, it hasn't turned out really well for the Democrats. So maybe they should be looking for a hard-fought primary this time, where when someone comes out of that June election, they've already fought a tough race and are ready to face whoever comes out of the Republican side.
All right. Greg, any thoughts on what this crowded field may portend? Does this necessarily mean that we're going to see someone on the far right for the Republicans and far right for the Democrats emerge, which I think is kind of the conventional wisdom, or not
well,
necessarily?
I don't really know what the far right means anymore. We just had this Republican primary in Alabama where you had a guy who I consider to be, you know, the extreme right wing running against a guy who was like so far to the right of him that, you know, you couldn't even, you know, find them in the same building. And so what is the far right? I look at the Republican field and it looks to me like they're all kind of parts of the what I would consider the hardcore conservative right. I don't see, you know, moderate names like Roger Cates or Rick Bennett or some other names that come up that who have appeal to some more of a Susan Collins voter. Perhaps if she announces that she's not getting in, we might see some more variety on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, there is a fairly big range. I think people are generally considering Adam Cody and Janet Mills to be at the center of their party, not necessarily conservative in the general electorate, but it, as Democrats go. And then you have Diane Russell and Betsy Sweet, who would be on the much more activist wing. I'm not sure right and left is going to help us so much in this environment. I think it'll end up being more anti-establishment versus establishment. I think that might be a more helpful way to look at the field. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I forgot your question.
I think you answered it, whatever it
was. Okay, good. Yeah, I must have. I talked for a long time.
So, Susan, you know, third party candidates, Elliot Cutler has said he is not going to run. Do we see anyone who could pose a, you know, could really gain some traction, get some votes?
At this point, I don't, from the independents who are in the race so far. I mean, the question, as someone mentioned before, is who else is going to get in the field? You know, Alan Caron is running, but I don't think he's going to take a lot of votes away from anyone else. We were talking before we came in about Cutler. He has said no, but if ranked choice voting is, in fact, you know, the way we're going to tabulate votes, be interesting to see. You know, that was his big campaign. Does he put that to the test with his own candidacy? I think, you know, it'd be hard to convince a lot of people that a third time's going to be a charm, but I wouldn't entirely rule that out.
Okay, so let's bring up ranked choice voting since you brought it up. where are we, Ben?
I think it's kind of in limbo right now. You know, it's the court issued the ruling saying that at least for the statewide races, it's probably unconstitutional. That kind of leaves the question of the federal races out there. You know, I think the best way forward, since people did vote for this and it people made their wishes clear on it, that they should put it in for the federal races and put a constitutional amendment out to the voters to see if this is really, after this clarification, is really the way they want to go, because all indications are that it is the way that voters want to go.
So it seems maybe unlikely for the gubernatorial election, but not.
I think, you know, it seems unlikely, period. I think the legislature is going to have to do something, or they're going to have an election that's going to end up in court. Mm-hmm. Republicans, people in Augusta hate the ranked choice voting for the same reason people voted for it, and it's because it's bad for parties. And most Mainers are not enrolled in a party. However, every single person in the state house is, with a couple of minor exceptions. So Republicans don't like ranked choice voting because it seems like a something dreamed up to prevent Paula LePage from winning the race. I think Democrats have done some math and figure that they can't really win a ranked choice race in 2018, and that they need to clear it off for before the general election. One of the leading Democratic candidates, Janet Mills, has been an outspoken critic of ranked choice voting right from the get-go, and I'm sure she will make that clear to Democratic lawmakers this year. And so it's unlikely that it's going to be in place for the general election. Are there votes to send it out for a constitutional amendment at 2/3 in both houses? I don't think so. Are there votes to repeal it completely? There may, in fact, be votes. So we may see the current legislature repeal the whole thing, and we just have our regular, you know, eight-way primaries, which we did have in 2010. We had a seven-way Democratic primary, you know, the winning candidate got something like 2% of the general election vote. So it's, you know, that's the system we've got.
Yeah, I don't envy legislators having to deal with this subject. And I agree with Greg. I mean, they've got some really bad choices in front of them, because if they completely do away with it, you've got the voters very unhappy that they didn't follow through. But having a system without ranked choice voting for statewide races, but having it for primaries and then for the federal race, just to me sounds like a logistical nightmare for town clerks, for the Secretary of State's office. And as Greg said, it'll end up in court, and that's how we'll find out who actually won some of these races. So they've got a very difficult job ahead of them.
Well, Susan, we had the long-awaited recommendation from Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke about Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. And I want you to correct me if I'm wrong. It was a recommendation to the president to open some or all of the land to harvesting, but we don't know if the president's going to accept that recommendation.
It's really even hard to know if that's exactly what he recommended. And first of all, the recommendations have not been released by the White House or the Department of Interior.
This was leaked.
This was leaked. The Washington Post obtained it first. So it would be helpful if the administration would just let the public know what their real recommendations are for Katahdin Woods and Waters and all the other monuments that were reviewed. There was one paragraph in his recommendations that said the management plan needed to be revised to protect, you know, Native American cultural sites and hunting and fishing. That paragraph appeared about every monument in his recommendations. The one thing that was different is he mentioned active timber management. There was no explanation of what that meant. And in his discussion points, not in the actual recommendations, but in his discussion, he pointed out that commercial timber harvesting is not allowed in national parks. So unfortunately, there's still a lack of clarity about what they really intend, what kind of harvesting, how widespread. Is it really commercial harvesting? Is it demonstration of historical forestry practices, as some people who were briefed by Secretary Zinke said it was? We still don't know. So it'd be nice if they could just say, here's what the recommendations are. And then, as you say, the next step, the president agrees or disagrees with those recommendations.
And do we have any idea of a timeline?
I think we have no idea.
I mean, it should be said that this land represents a tiny fraction of the logging in Maine. Having it logged, not having it logged, does not make a difference to the forestry industry. And this whole review, including Maine's in this review, which really had more to do with Western lands and people concerned over what was happening out there, which is a totally different federal-state relationship than we have here in Maine. Maine was included in this because of politics, because of Governor LePage's opposition to it, and because President Obama put it in, and we can't have any of those things lasting. It's not about I don't think it's about supporting the forestry industry. I think it's about kind of throwing a bone to opponents of the monument and saying, we're not letting them change everything they're doing up there when it really might not have a matter. But the real sad part is that this is, as Susan said, more uncertainty to a region that doesn't need it after all this time.
All right. Well, guess what? We have to take a break. When we come back, we'd like to hear what you think about the top news stories that affected Maine in September. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Quarry Hill, proud sponsor of Poldark on Masterpiece. Season 3 premieres Sunday, October 1st on Maine Public Television. And REMAX, committed to being the most recognized brand in real estate with 25 offices throughout Maine. Remax.com.
Nationwide, farmers are struggling to get enough workers to harvest their crops. So why not hire Americans?
We've tried. We really have. Sometimes people come out on a day like today and they'll pick one box and then they're gone.
Some growers say President Trump's anti-immigrant stance has made a chronic worker shortage even worse. Listen this afternoon to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Part 9 of filmmaker Ken Burns' The Vietnam War is this evening at 8 on Maine Public Television. Tonight, South Vietnamese forces fighting on their own suffer a terrible defeat in Laos. After being re-elected in a landslide, Nixon strikes a peace deal with Hanoi that allows American prisoners of war finally to come home to a bitterly divided country. Tonight's repeat is at 10 o'clock. And don't forget, all of this week's episodes will repeat this Sunday from 8:30 in the morning to 6 in the evening. And the entire series is available on demand at mainepublic.org through Passport or any of the PBS apps for Roku, Apple TV, and others.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the news that made headlines in September. With me in the studio, Greg Kasich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. He also hosts the Press Herald podcast. Susan Young is editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. Ben Bragdon, the editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to calls, though, I want to talk about a news release that just crossed my computer screen right before the program from Bruce Poliquin's office, expressing sadness but not surprise that Anthem is leaving nearly all of the Obamacare marketplace. Greg, you know about this as well. What's its significance?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that despite all the heat and smoke around healthcare over the last 7 months, they didn't actually do anything. The problems with Obamacare, which are recognized by everybody on all sides of the political spectrum, are that there's this, it gets expensive for companies to price these plans because they don't know how many people are going to buy them and how sick they are going to be. And so add that to an administration that's actually hostile to the program, that is doing things to raise doubt about what the government participation is going to be. Plus, the party that's in control of both houses of Congress is actively, by the week, coming out with new plans to tear it apart. You fuel this uncertainty, and that is going to make things even worse. Representative Poliquin, says that he's sad, but really, I think we should remember that Republicans get a lot of political mileage out of everything bad that happens to the Affordable Care Act. So this kind of, feeds his conversation, his argument.
And as Greg said, I mean, the uncertainty is the key point here. In their statement, Anthem, cited the shrinking individual market, but also the uncertainty at the federal level. And they said that they needed a stable market and a known set of conditions to set rates. So as Greg said, when you have all these efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, with the Trump administration making it more difficult for people to enroll, they don't know how many people they're going to have. They don't know what their health status is. And you can't run a market. They're a business. You can't run a health insurance market when you don't know the answers to those questions.
Yeah, it should be remembered that Representative Poliquin voted in the House for a health care bill that would have decimated health care. And he is part of a party that has been, as both Greg and Susan pointed out, has been trying to undermine this bill. And there's no doubt there's a lot of people who are hurt by parts of Obamacare because of how it was written and because of how it was implemented in the states. And but when he says in that press release that people are continuing to be hurt by Obamacare, and he's not offering any help. There's that bill he voted for in the House would not have solved these problems.
We have a tweet from Allison. She writes, an email. My topmost concern is the escalation of rhetoric and insults by Donald Trump and Kim Jong-il of North Korea. This affects Mainers in every possible way. I've asked Senators Collins and King and Congressman Poliquin to please find courses of action that Congress can take to ratchet back their trajectory toward nuclear war. So that's from Allison. We'll move on to Isaac, who's calling from Farmington. Hi, Isaac. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there. My name is Isaac. I am the chair of the Maine Federation of College Republicans here in Maine. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on the impact young people will have on the governor's race next year. You guys talked a lot about the different people that are running, kind of not a big standout yet. But what are the thoughts you guys have about that?
I would hope they would play a large role, but as we've seen in past elections, young voters don't have a great track record of showing up to vote, especially in primaries. So I would encourage them to get educated, get involved, and show up to vote. But I will just point out that it's your party that's trying to make it more difficult for college kids to vote, trying to put in restrictions on voter registration, targeting just college kids, which, of course, is against the Constitution, sending them intimidating letters, reminding them if they don't register their cars or have a driver's license, they can't vote here. So support as full participation as possible in voting, but let's not throw up roadblocks to that, especially to young people, because we need more of them to be engaged.
Isaac, do you sense more energy among young people than in years past?
Yeah, definitely. This past election, for sure, with the presidential election, I continuously remember so many people, young people, walking to the polls right near in Farmington, where I go to school. Lots of people participated in the discussions on campus and different things like that. So, on both sides of the aisle, everyone seemed to be engaged. Whether or not they, all of them, voted or not, is a different discussion, for sure.
Isaac, you're a college Republican in Farmington?
Yes.
Is that a lonely place to be?
No, there's a good group of us.
Good to hear.
And let me, while I've still got you on the phone, Isaac, because it's so great to hear a young voice talk about politics. What are the issues that matter to you and to your friends?
Yeah, definitely. We definitely have talk a lot about the foreign policy issues going on right now. On both sides of the aisle, we had lots of discussions about the different referendums last year, and even the ones coming up this year with the expansion of Medicaid in the state as well. I think really we all talk about the same stuff. And how it affects our lives, how now and in future years as we live here in Maine or wherever we end up, for sure.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in, Isaac, chair of the Young College Republicans, calling from Farmington, Maine. We're going to move to Jeff, calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you very much. Well, I'm full of opinions on many matters. What I'm calling about right now is the Cottonwoods and Waters. I keep hearing talk about the president, you know, modifying it or rescinding it or have you. But since it was a gift from Susan Quimby, and as I understand it, came with substantial endowment, are there conditions that she placed on the transfer of the land to create the monument? And that's specific to that park and the money that goes with it. And the other question is, in general, does any president have the power to rescind a national monument created by another president? As I understand, the legislation that creates that gives the president the power to create them doesn't contain anything about rescinding them, that would be up to Congress. So I wonder if I could just get your insights and thoughts on those two issues. Thank you.
Susan.
Jeff, you raise a really good point about what President Trump's powers would be in terms of modifying this monument. And I think the answer is, we don't know. It's not happened before. And so what is possible, we'll have to find out. And as so many other issues, it will likely end up in court. And potentially the same thing if there are dramatic changes that the Quimby family doesn't agree to. I mean, they don't own the land anymore. The federal government does. But there were some terms that were put into the deeds of transfer. And if the federal government does not fulfill those terms, I suppose it's potential that the Quimby family could sue and, you know, either ask for the land or the endowment money or both back. But I think we're a long way from knowing whether they would go down that road.
Jeff, thanks for your call. I want to talk about something else that I have a feeling the answer is we don't know. The controversy that seems to be unfolding this week in Cumberland County, where Governor LePage has told the sheriff of Cumberland County, Sheriff Joyce, that he would fire him. This in response to, or could fire him, or might fire him, and other sheriffs who don't hold immigration and customs detainees. The sheriff of Cumberland County, Greg, has said, I can't. It's unconstitutional to hold someone if there's not a warrant.
Right.
Is this the Maine Constitution versus the U.S. Constitution?
Not
this...
really.
Okay.
No, I mean, the Maine Constitution has a provision that lets a governor remove a sheriff or start a process to remove a sheriff if they're not following the law. So this is a situation where somebody is arrested for anything. It could be a minor crime, could be driving under suspension, say. And when they go to the jail, they get fingerprinted and their name and records go into a federal database. And in some cases, the federal government may say, we have a suspicion that this person might be in the country illegally. Would you hold them? Meanwhile, the process goes forward on the other case. And if it's a minor crime, you most likely are offered bail and you leave, you know. And what the sheriff is saying is once I'm not holding him for that other crime, I can't hold him because a federal agency's computer tells me that maybe he might have been violating some civil infraction. So these are not, you know, be clear, there's no judicial process that determines whether or not this person is actually in the country illegally. It's just a suggestion that they could be. And that's a dispute, and it's happening in jails all over the country. Jails are run by sheriffs. Sheriffs run for election. They tend to be very conservative, pro-law and order type politicians who align very well with Trump on a number of issues, and of course Governor LePage as well. So it's funny to see them as, you know, some kind of screaming liberal, you know, I'm opening the borders and letting everybody in. What they're doing is a very basic obligation they have under the Fourth Amendment to not hold somebody unless there's probable cause that they've committed a crime.
All right.
Yeah, this isn't, I was just going to say, this isn't a political stance they're making, you know, something about immigration or ICE. This is just them following the Constitution and worried about opening themselves up to liability on that end of thing. They should be worried about immigration enforcement, I think. I think some of the stories of ICE around the country here are very alarming, what they're doing and who they're picking up, and you know, without any prioritizing of the worst criminals, they're just separating families and pulling people who have been here for a long time away. People should be concerned about this, but that's not why the sheriffs are doing this, from what I can tell.
Susan, I mean, this is really focusing on Cumberland County. The York County Sheriff has spoken up and said he's concerned as well. Is this really a statewide issue, or is this a Southern Maine issue?
I think it is a statewide issue. I mean, the sheriff in Washington County said, in essence, he would comply, but he really wanted to see a court order before he would hold anyone. And, you know, Greg summarized it very well, what the sheriff's concerns are. And in fact, you know, their concerns were bolstered by the Massachusetts Supreme Court, which ruled that sheriffs cannot hold someone against without a court order. They can't be held for a, you know, reason just to allow the feds to spend some more time looking into this person. They call that civil arrest. And in essence, you're holding this person under arrest after they have been released either from serving time or been bailed. And, you know, that's a violation of the Constitution. So you can't do that. So courts in other states have already ruled that sheriffs are not allowed to do this.
Okay, well, we're talking about the news in Maine in September. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. I'll repeat that, 1-800-399-3566. We are going to take another short break, but first, a look ahead at tomorrow's show. We have the gardening experts back. We'll get tips on late season harvest, fall plantings, and seed saving. So email us your comments and questions about that. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet us or post on our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And the You Maine New Writing Series, sponsor of Maine Public's Poems from Here, heard Fridays on Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical. And instead of on the court or out on the field, high school student teams compete in the areas of science, history, math, current events, and popular culture. It's High School Quiz Show Maine, Season 2. We're looking for high school teams from all around Maine to take the qualifying test later this fall, which then results in the top 16 teams taking part in the on-air competition this winter on Maine Public Television. How to sign up your high school, as well as how to form a team, the rules, the schedule, and video of last year's contestants are all at mainepublic.org. We're hoping to hear from all interested high schools by mid-October. We hope you can join us, and thanks. Coming up at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling, it's World Affairs, an exploration on the ways philanthropy can help rebuild social capital and restore societal cohesion. That's World Affairs at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, The Month in Review. Joining me today, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, also the host of the Press Herald podcast. If you'll join our conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Big thing we haven't talked about yet is the fact that there are legislators meeting this week to discuss how Maine's new marijuana law will look. What do we know?
That it's very complicated. Anyone who listened to the hearing yesterday knows that this is just a huge undertaking by the committee. They have to decide on who can sell it, where, the taxes, the fees, who can grow it and where and how much and for what use, and all the safety and law enforcement issues and licensing issues and fee issue. It's amazing. When they first passed this law and they said it was going to take a while, we were critical of that. We said that they should move this along and make it faster and at least implement it on some level. But getting into it, you can see just how big of a thing it is for them to wrap their hands around. And it's a very only a few states have done this. We don't have a lot of experience with it, and there's a lot even within the pro marijuana side. There's all these different factions who have very different ideas about how this should be implemented. Then you also have the anti marijuana people trying to figure out how to shape that. I'm glad I don't have to do it.
Is there any kind of when do we have to have this inked by, or is there no have to have?
There's deadlines, but the legislators make laws and they can push the deadline off. I think this, to me, it shows kind of one of the, well, this both the strength and the weakness of the referendum process. It's a kind of big question whether or not marijuana should be legalized that you're not going to get out of the legislature. Where they would just sort of take it on themselves and change the this longstanding practice. You really needed to hear from the voters to do it. But the voters, who knows what they were voting on? That was a complicated piece of legislation, and there was lots of little angles. Now when people say, oh, the voters said the tax should be 10%, or the voters said that you should be able to smoke in a social club, you know, some voters said that. But it's really difficult to kind of, unwind the spaghetti and figure out exactly, what the rules should be.
Do we know anything at this point, though? My impression is we know that towns and cities are going to have a lot of latitude into even whether they allow social clubs or.
Yeah, it's the way the law's written, and I think this will survive, is that it gives towns the ability to ban retail shops and to ban growing, and a lot of them have done moratoriums while the legislature figures this out. Some other towns like Hollowell are embracing it, saying this could be a economic driver if it's done right. But you can see the concerns. I mean, people don't want a huge grow facility next to them, but it's got to go somewhere. And figuring those things out is very difficult, especially in a question that passed by a very slim margin. And yeah. So, and it's something that, you know, you can't just say, well, now it's legal and that's the law of the land. You really have to take in consideration the, whatever, 49% who voted no. And even the people who voted yes, but maybe don't want their neighbor growing, you know, a ton of weed and you can smell it in your house.
Another layer of complexity is that Maine already allows medical marijuana. And so what is going to be the interplay between those growers, those dispensaries, and the new folks that get in just for commercial sales? On one hand, you can see that it might make sense to let the current medical marijuana dispensaries go first because they already have rules and regulations in place. But on the other hand, you could see how commercial facilities would say that's unfair to give them a leg up. So that's going to be a difficult area for lawmakers to navigate. I think one thing that where there's a little bit more clarity is the tax rate. I mean, I know there's some opposition, but the revised bill proposes a 20% tax rate, which would certainly put Maine more in line with the other states that do sell marijuana for recreational use. I think 10% was really, really low. I believe Colorado is something like 37% with local taxes. And so if we're going to do this, let's have the revenue to make sure that, you know, we can police and regulate, but also, you know, the state should get some revenue that can be used for other purposes as well. So a higher tax rate, I think, is a good thing.
Yeah, you can't underestimate how much money is at stake here, both for the state and for the businesses that come in. And it's funny to think that we had all these questions about the ranked choice voting and all these other referendums that were went to the legislature, and really the only one there was never any serious there was never any serious talk in the legislature about repealing this one, and that's because everyone saw the tax money
right.
And said, "This is, you know, great. I want it for schools. I want it for infrastructure." You know, everyone sees that pot of money, and
even the governor spent it in his budget.
Right. Yeah.
That's a good point. We're going to go to Mike, who's calling from Augusta. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, I was calling, inquiring into the MATR, Medicaid assistance agreement for opiate addiction. And it seems like the state has not addressed a lot of the issues, more in specific to the amount of providers out there that are willing and or able to actually offer the service, such as Suboxone, or in particular.
Yeah, sure, Mike. And I encourage you to go back. We had a long discussion about this on Maine Calling just about a week ago, so you can find that online. But, Greg, the Press Herald did a really big series on Maine's opioid epidemic earlier this year. Layers and layers of problems, and this is one of them.
Yes. I mean, there's been some action. The state is spending some amount more money on medicine-assisted treatment, which is more people are more familiar with methadone, but also Suboxone, which is supplied, prescribed by doctors. But the legislature could not get anything big passed because they couldn't get around consensus on really. I think the core question is this a matter of personal responsibility? Or is it a real medical illness? And the people who just feel like it's a character flaw, which includes the governor and the administration of the DHHS, were able to prevent anything really meaningful to happen in terms of expanding access to treatment. And the way our Medicaid laws work in Maine, it's very difficult for a single adult with no children to get coverage through Medicaid. And boy, that just about describes most of the people with opiate problems.
And when we did our program, Ricker Hamilton, who's acting commissioner of DHHS, called in to say, you know, basically we're doing a lot more than we used to, but it's, you know, it's not going to be fast enough. There's no way it can be fast enough. There aren't enough trained providers. There's not enough, you know, you can't just snap your fingers.
No, he's right. They are doing more than they used to.
Yeah. Mike, thank you so much for your call. Let's see. I'm going to go here to an email from James. I found it interesting this morning. We'll listen to Morning Edition. That there was a discussion of the proposed tax plan. And I heard this as well, James. I'm glad you brought it up. The conservative commentator said that able-bodied men from Bangor, Maine should not be sitting at home receiving welfare. And he went on to say Susan Collins was bringing these benefits to Maine. It seems obvious to me that this is a reaction to her lack of support for the ACA repeal. Did any of you guys hear this as well?
No, but that's interesting.
But use this. It was a University of Maryland conservative economics professor used Bangor, Maine as the example of the place where there were able-bodied men sitting at home either collecting Social Security or disability benefits that they shouldn't.
Yeah.
Your town's a
Is that what it's like in Bangor?
Yeah, they should come visit.
But Susan, I do want to bring up another point that just, you know, go take us back a couple weeks to another thing that was in the headlines and isn't right now. Is this is the news that the governor had withheld federal job training funding. Tell me about that. Remind us.
It was about $9 million in federal funds that are used to help people who have lost a job and laid off retrain for other employment. It can cover tuition costs to go to a community college or university. It can cover health care costs. The intent is to lower or remove the barriers for people who need help and, you know, continuing or reentering the workforce. It's another situation where the LePage administration was not clear about why they're doing this. The governor had asked the federal government on two occasions to reorganize the state's workforce board, taking, I believe it was eight, and narrowing it down to one statewide board, and the federal government said no. So is this just a temper tantrum reaction to that? Again, it would be helpful if they would communicate with the local groups that run these programs to let them know what they're actually doing and why. But this kind of training is so essential, you know, as we see tens of thousands of Mainers aren't in the workforce. Working age people just aren't participating. So anything we can do to get them back in the workforce is going to help the state and the state economy. So these kind of programs to get rid of barriers and get people back to work are very important.
All right. And before we go, we just have a couple minutes. I want to ask about you, your reaction, your thoughts about the whole NFL, some players taking a knee, some players linking arms, Jerry Jones of the Dallas Cowboys linking arms and taking a knee after Donald Trump's tweets. I read something recently that suggested that Trump is doing this in a very calculated way to be a distraction from other things going on.
I was wondering about that, too. Or he seemed to want to draw attention to certain segments of the Alabama electorate. Which is where he originally made those comments. And so I was wondering if this was just a way to, you know, suck up all the news energy in, you know, in the, put a black hole of news energy in the Alabama Senate race. You know, to me, it's last month we were talking about the Civil War monuments, and I see a similarity here in that we don't really have a very good way of talking about race, especially white people. And so we take on these kind of proxy arguments about something other than the thing that we're really talking about. And when he says, you know, it's a disgrace that these football players don't respect the flag, he's talking about a group of black football players who are protesting police violence against black people, and that's a statement they made. And they are not fooling around and having a good time during the national anthem. They are they were making a statement using the platform that they have. So it would be nice if we could talk about the actual subject and not get so divided on the symbols and the ephemera around the real topic.
Yeah, look what's happened in the last few days. They were kneeling because of the what they see as racial inequities in our society. That's what's been going on. If you listen to them, to the players that have knelt, then that's what they speak very well on that subject. But since Donald Trump spoke, it's really become about their ability to do that. And it became this attack on NFL players. And so you had the Steelers stay in. You know, they screwed that up, but they didn't even come out as a team. You had the Cowboys and the Jerry Jones come out and sit. And so now we're all talking about freedom of speech. We're not talking about why they were kneeling in the first place, which is the racial problems in this country. And so we've just completely lost the thread on that.
Yeah, insightful point to end on. Thank you all again for being back here. Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Susan Young, editorial page editor of Bangor Daily News. Greg Kasich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling.